Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us here in South Africa. Welcome. I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, defense lines harden as South Africa is pulled into global power games. South Africa's water systems under increasing strain as experts warn of looming failure. Africa's youth dividend is real, but only if people come first. And we'll put the earned wage access model under scrutiny. It's Monday, the 19th of January. Pressure is mounting on the government and the SANDF after fresh questions emerging over who authorized Iran's participation in a South African-hosted naval exercise and whether the military followed political instructions. The row has reignited debate about civilian oversight, command discipline, and also South Africa's strategic posture at a very sensitive geopolitical moment. I'm in conversation now with Ricardo Teixeira, who's a defense analyst at the SA Institute of Race Relations. Ricardo, welcome. Let's wade straight in here. Who ultimately decides which countries the SANDF trains with? Is it the politicians or the generals?
This is a foreign policy decision. So ultimately, this comes down to the president and Defense Foreign Relations and DIRCO as well. This is something where multiple departments overlap, but ultimately everything rests on the shoulders of the commander-in-chief, who is the president. But important to note, again, that with this exercise, it seems China invited all the participants, and China did most of the planning.
If any instructions, Ricardo, during this process were ignored, is that misconduct or do you think it's systemic failure?
I think it is a level of misconduct that has risen to the point of systemic failure, because we've had several of the chiefs and generals making political remarks and going off the script and trying to forge their own foreign policy paths. We've seen this with the chief of the defense force who went to go visit Iran and made political statements there. We've seen it with the chief of the Navy. I think at this point it is a symptom of a growing rift between the military and its civilian oversight.
What is leading to that growing rift? And what does it say then about ill discipline, Ricardo, within the armed forces itself?
If I have to be brutally honest, I think that this is the result of the ANC's policy in our defense cluster over the last 31 years. We've seen, since 1994, with the restructuring of our defense force, one of the biggest failures of the ANC in this regard has been a failure to craft a vision and a purpose for the defense force. The strategies that come out piecemeal every few years and are rarely related to one another and leave the defense force often misguided. And without a strategy, there is no doctrine. As the saying goes, if one knows not to which port one is sailing, no wind is favorable. And that, coupled with the underfunding, has put the defense force in a point where it isn't happy with the president, it isn't happy with the Department of Finance, it isn't happy with Parliament. And that they seem to have gone rogue and decided to do their own thing.
And if that unhappiness perpetuates, what then?
I think we're in some serious trouble. I don't think the Defence Force is capable of pulling off a coup. They do not have the capability and they do not have the capacity. But I think we're in some serious trouble where we've got potentially a mutiny on our hands where the Defence Force is not following the instructions of the president. And I think that is an indictment on the president's leadership and the president's authority.
So how does he act then, do you think?
I think, as my colleague Darren Ullifield has said, I think there needs to be some serious consequences here. I know Peter Fabricius also had an article in Daily Maverick this morning where he said, you know, some generals need to be fired. I think Chief of the Defence Force, General Rudzani Maphonya, he's past the point of retirement. He was supposed to retire 5 years ago, but then was made Chief of the Defence Force and turned 65 in November. So he's past the point of retirement already. And he's had multiple stains on his record, the handling of the Rogue Special Forces Unit, which was the his previous post was General Officer Commanding Special Forces. So he has that on him, and to say that he didn't know about the activities of such rogue units, I do not believe. And then with his visit to Iran and now this, there have been several reasons for Maphonya to go. Chief Joint Ops as well, with these exercises, the whichever branches are involved, they hand their forces over to Joint Ops, and these instructions and exercises are carried out under Joint Ops. So I think Chief Joint Ops also needs to account. The Chief of Navy also needs to account. And the Minister. The Minister, whether she gave the instruction and whether she saw it being followed through or knew it was being rebuffed and decided to ignore that, she needs to account as well.
Apart from the leadership that you've outlined at the top echelons, it also says a lot, doesn't it, about the broader culture within the SANDF, and that is very worrying, particularly when it comes to capability.
Yes, and look, if we look at our intelligence structures, our policing structures, and our defense force, overall, our security cluster is not in a good shape. The government doesn't seem to acknowledge it. It doesn't seem to want to deal with the problem. We are seeing all the things coming out of the Madlanga Commission, everything the Zondo Commission said about our intelligence structures. And now we are seeing the problems with our defense force play out in public. And I think we are in some serious trouble, and we are in need of some serious reforms. We need some seriously competent leadership to take hold of the reins here and to come up with a serious plan. I mean, the 2015 Defence Review is now going on 11 years ago. That was never implemented. Our national security strategy from 2024 was overly ambitious but vague at the same time, and a little bit naive in thinking that the government's ambition can be matched by defence capacity that isn't funded. Given the state of everything, we need to go back to the drawing board and to some extent start over.
And if that doesn't happen, and this is a quick final question, this is further damaging to South Africa's credibility abroad, and I imagine would affect intelligence and defence cooperation with key partners such as they are.
Yes, I mean, if we look at everything now, I think the result of the Second Battle of Goma, which was less than a year ago, coming up on its first anniversary on Friday, the result of that battle deeply damaged our defense credibility and our international diplomatic credibility. But I think this has done equal, if not more, damage to it. And South Africa, if it wants to continue being such a big player on the global diplomatic stage, this rhetoric needs to be matched with some actual capacity on the defense side. We can't pretend that we just have a carrot and it's going to get us anywhere. We need to have the stick too.
Thank you very much indeed. Ricardo Teixeira, defense analyst at the SA Institute of Race Relations. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Severe flooding in Limpopo, deepening shortages here in Johannesburg, deteriorating dam levels in Nelson Mandela Bay, and contamination risks in Knysna, all pointing to a national water infrastructure network that is under extreme and simultaneous stress. Risk expert Volker van Vidden from RiskNet Africa is warning that we are now entering a phase where chronic underinvestment, collapsing wastewater plants, leaks, climate volatility, and failing oversight could trigger, he says, cascading failures across cities and industries. It's a worrying situation. Volker, a very warm welcome. You describe the water system as close to breaking. What does that mean, in your opinion, in practical terms for households and businesses, let's say in the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, the issue, though, is that it means something immediate and sudden when there's no water in the taps or there's no water in the bulk supply because of a major peril. And that's the real difficulty, is there's no visibility of what is going to happen to your water supply until, you know, the catastrophic event happens, such as no water in the pipe, or you're notified of a major repair and you'll be cut off for whatever period of time, or there'll be a constraint of resources. And I think that that's the first problem of what does it mean compared to what it could or should mean, and with the right understanding of the whole network, as you introduced, which is why we talk about the resource, the treatment, the distribution and consumption. And if you look at all those four segments carefully, one can do a lot better compared to the outcomes that we are facing right now.
It's extraordinary that we're seeing flooding in Limpopo and simultaneously shortages here in Johannesburg. And as simplistic as this question is, we've got to ask how a country can be hit by both too much water and too little water at the same time. It reveals something, doesn't it, about system design and planning failure, surely?
Yes, and of course, climate change is a tough one to solve in a country with constrained resources like ourselves. But climate change is not sudden. It's been on our doorstep for the last 10 or 20 years. And the silting of dams is another issue, and that is a matter about land use and management and overgrazing and the like. So when we think about flooding, it's the compound effect of severe rain, which we can't really control. But if we're not looking after our land resources and keeping the grasses and the other things in place, we will add to the flooding problem, and the dams won't manage the severe water spikes as they plan to. So that's why we talk about resource. Understand what is happening to the resource, what the impacts of climate change will be, why are we having silting and poor effective performance of our dams, and what's going on there, then through to treatment, which is the water treatment plants, and making the best use of that and not further poisoning our water sources through that end. So there are significant changes that can be delivered by proper analysis and respond to these things 10 or 20 years out.
But not too late, one hopes. You mentioned decades of underinvestment. Who should be held accountable for instance, allowing wastewater plants, reservoirs, pipelines to reach this level of collapse? Again, surely better risk management a decade ago could have prevented this.
Well, risk management, of course, identifies the triggers. One of the key issues because of water, and we've noticed it with electricity, is inconsistent and non-strategic medium to long-term investment. So if you have either government departments or local authorities that have swung a large proportion of their expenditure to salaries and services and away from infrastructure maintenance and development, you will run out of infrastructure. If you're not paying attention to the infrastructure that you have, then that's obviously a risk event, but it's a strategic error in management. So if you first don't have the money, and two, you don't apply the money the correct way, you can call those risks or errors in management, but that's how we've got here. And then you overlay the strategic responses that we should be planning, which relate to issues like El Nino, El Niño, climate change, and the rest. So that's another layer of strategic intervention that we should be applying. But at the moment, we're fighting fires, you know, at the tap front instead of on the strategic front.
You rightly point out that it's difficult to manage climate change, but we can ask whether South Africa is prepared for the next extreme weather shock. The flooding in Limpopo, for instance, the Kruger Park exposing major vulnerabilities. Worst case scenario, what would happen if a similar event hit Gauteng or even Nelson Mandela Bay?
Well, of course, we've seen a little bit of this, but so the Des Moines a cyclone got all the way into the Kruger and got far into South Africa. And we saw how, you know, water levels rise 10, 20 meters, and then you have an extreme problem. The same happened with KZN. And we see what happens again with waterways and flood channels that are meant to be clear and let the water run, but were not properly maintained, and therefore the water blocked and rose too quickly and flooded the industrial plants next to the old airport. So the first thing is understand what defenses we do have and make sure that they're effective and can deal with higher levels of precipitation. And I think those levels of assessment and execution need a lot of attention right now. And then one needs to build further protections, because the old models of the 100-year flood line and the like are no longer relevant. So we have to model further into that area and say, what are we going to do about this? Now, contrary to that, we're developing in unplanned fashions, water management, stormwater drains are being filled with waste and the rest. In fact, it looks like we're going in the opposite direction.
And just finally, as far as businesses are concerned, the private sector, you say solutions exist, but what's the single most urgent action that they could be taking right now to mitigate?
Well, I think it's a realization that bulk water is very difficult to replace, and that the old reliance or assumption that bulk water just comes in a pipe is something that one really has to consider. So rain harvesting and communal, in other words, business park related storage of bulk water on site and harvested water is going to be an increasing need over time as areas of infrastructure continue to feel stress. Because to truck in water for an industrial facility that needs water for production, and as we've mentioned, it requires 10,000 odd liters to produce a pair of jeans and 15,000 liters to produce a kilo of beef. There's a huge amount of water that's needed in various production facilities. And water storage on site and in commercial operations, I think, is going to be a new strategic requirement.
Thank you very much indeed, risk expert Volker van Verden from RiscoNet Africa. Volker, appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
As global leaders head to the World Economic Forum, Africa brings a very different kind of power to the table, and that's people power. With the world's youngest workforce, the continent is arguing, and arguing strongly, that human capital is its greatest untapped advantage. But my question is, does this narrative actually match economic reality? Are we reskilling fast enough? Are we employing young people at scale? And are we preparing for an intelligence age where automation might outpace opportunity? That's a worry. And someone who's applying her mind to that is Christine Wu, who's Interim Chief Executive Officer for Personal and Private Banking at Absa. And I want to discuss whether Africa is ready to turn demographic potential into economic strength. And Christine, welcome to you. So it's such an important issue because the continent has the world's youngest workforce, but also, as we well know, some of the highest youth unemployment. It's often difficult to reconcile those two ends of the spectrum, isn't it?
That's exactly right. And thank you for having me, Jeremy. So from my perspective, I think it is important to acknowledge that Africa can be the next growth engine for the world. But we have to actually, in the process, figure out, instead of mining natural resources, how do we actually turn our attention to mine the human resources?
Are we doing that sufficiently right now, do you think? Or is it a concept that we maybe just pay lip service to?
I think there is a lot more to be done. And this is actually partly about preparing our youth to compete globally for jobs. I think globally by 2030, 900 million youth, you know, will be reaching the job-seeking age. But, you know, we are actually in the game to actually compete globally for these new jobs. So we have to actually rethink and remodel what exactly that demand and supply equation look like.
Before we can remodel, we have to have a firm understanding of what the obstacles are. What do you think they are?
I think there are a couple of things. First of all, we need to start by looking at the education readiness. First of all, we need to critically examine whether our youth have the right functional skills in addition to what we've been talking about, math and science. It's about digital readiness. It's about digital literacy, data literacy. But in addition to that, particularly in the age of AI, we also have to start to apply our minds on cultivating skills such as critical thinking. Integrative thinking. How do we actually unleash creativity? How do we actually instill a sense of aspiration? Because these are skills and attributes that AI cannot replace. And until we can actually equip our young people with these new skills, we will be at risk.
Okay, ball back in your court. How do we accelerate that digital literacy then?
So I think there are a couple of things that for me is critical. First of all, I think we need to break down this digital divide in terms of access to broadband, because that's the beginning of everything. And at the same time, I think also strengthening our foundational access to proper math and science skills. I think the matric results has just come out. And at the moment, we are seeing that about 20% of our young people have actually got a matric in math. So these are not the type of foundation that we can actually accelerate our digital ambition.
Which tells me that South Africa in particular, Christine, is falling further and further behind the curve in that respect. We should be worried.
And at the same time, I think with the advent of digital and with AI, we also have an opportunity to disrupt and leapfrog ourselves. We've seen in many instances in overseas, you know, they've actually used AI to tutor themselves, which actually removes some of the bottlenecks that we've got, that the dependency on the existing education system. If we can actually unleash an alternative digital and AI-driven way of educating our young people.
In terms of the relationship then between the private sector, you sit in that space, and government that also has a huge role to play, particularly when it comes to issues like broadband, for instance. Is there enough coalescing of thought and cooperation and collaboration? Again, I would suggest to you that there's a deficit there.
I do think it is a conversation that is starting to unfold, and we always need to take infrastructure a step at a time. I think a sound infrastructure for AI and digital starts with proper access to electricity and having electricity stability. And actually, if you really want to be creating that kind of access at scale, that stability is essential. And I do think from that perspective, we have made tremendous progress as a country, but we need to now build on that and actually figure out how do we make that affordable and actually reliable, and then from there to actually also expand on the infrastructure.
And key to your thinking is what you term African-led education models. What does that mean?
I think there are some really beautiful aspects of the Africa culture, the focus on humanity, the focus on collaboration, the focus on innovation, and also coupled with the significant social challenges, it has created a huge amount of potential for innovation to be unleashed, to be tapped into, to really give AI and all these technologies meaning. So I do think it's not about just adopting whatever everyone else is doing, but also really looking at the richness of the culture, which we can actually use to our advantage to advance the continent.
You're painting a very optimistic and hopeful picture, and I guess many people would say that's a good thing. But we also live in an increasingly competitive world. If you had to, for instance, benchmark Africa against Southeast Asia, for instance, we don't do particularly well. Where do you think we're falling behind?
Jeremy, I think the risk is if we are only focusing on status quo, on optimizing and to just leverage whatever is there. What we have seen in the examples that you are mentioning in Southeast Asia, in Asia in general, is that within a generation, with the right bold leadership and with creativity and with the right level of investment, within a generation, one can turn this around. For example, if you look at what the Chinese have done with electric vehicles, the decision was made in early 2000 to pivot the focus. And within 20 years, they have actually created something. But the same can be the same type of thinking, the same type of bold leadership and commitment from the country can actually also be applied into figuring out what are exactly the areas of distinctiveness that we want to pursue as a country and go from there.
So taking all of that as you head towards the World Economic Forum, how do you articulate that message, and how do you come back with some indication of success and that people have actually heard you?
There are a couple of important key messages. First of all, Africa is not only about natural resources. Mm. There is a huge amount of human capital to be tapped into. Secondly, I think there are some important cultural elements that will fast track and accelerate and will be ideal for how we actually create value in the age of AI. However, we need to be super pragmatic and extremely sober about the challenges that we experience and actually pick our battles. But when we've actually done that, go in with bold leadership and focused investment, because that is how we're going to charter a much more exciting future collectively.
I hope it's not too cold in Davos.
I hope so too.
Christine Wu, Interim Chief Executive Officer, Personal and Private Banking at Absa. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, there's an interesting new impact report from earned wage access provider PayMeNow that suggests many South African workers are finding real relief from financial stress between paydays. Now, that's almost counterintuitive. According to the independently compiled study, 94% of users are reporting an improved quality of life. I want to get under the skin of the story, and joining me to discuss what's behind the numbers and what they really tell us about the pressures facing workers is Dion Nobrega, Chief Executive Officer of PayMeNow. Dion, a very warm welcome to you. That headline number, 94%, is strong. What should listeners know then, firstly, about how studies like this are tested and verified?
Yeah, Jeremy, a big statement like 94% report improvement in their quality of life is obviously a big number. And this is something that we've been tracking since PayMeNow actually started about 5 years ago in South Africa. And it is independently verified by global research company 60 Decibels. We interview typically a good couple of hundred of our customer base every single year. And we track what impact a solution like earned wage access and specifically PayMeNow has on their lives. And the question of, does PayMeNow improve your quality of life, is open-ended, but the answers come back and is coded and certain trends emerge in the data. And 94% of people have actually quoted that it improves their quality of life, 2/3 of them stating significant improvements. And some of those trends that come out is reduction in stress, financial independence, access to emergency funds when they need it. So it really is solving a purpose and a gap in the market that I'd love to tell you more about.
Well, let's get there in just a moment, but let me come back at you and say that there is a difference, surely, which you've got to separate between real impact from perception, particularly, Dion, when money stress, as we all know, is something that is very emotional.
Yeah, so Jeremy, you know, your typical South African is paid monthly, and unfortunately, they paid quite a modest income. And if you look at how times have changed, we look at your, let's take your average South African that probably works 20 to 22 days a month. Now, that means having to commute to work and back, and most South Africans do make use of public transport or some kind of a taxi service. So that's 42 to 44 cash in hand transactions every single month. And imagine being paid monthly, but having that level of cash frequency that you have to manage happening on an ongoing basis. People have to top up their airtime and electricity every few days. Emergencies happen all the time. Now, when people don't have access to quality financial services and they've got all these cash outflows going on all the time, managing that becomes a big challenge for them. And unfortunately, historically, when you look at the financial services sector, the cost to serve the lower income base has always been very difficult. It's very expensive because you can't actually monetize traditionally. And in comes a fintech service like earned wage access, where we are able to serve people at a fraction of the cost, which translates to a service at the fraction of a cost. And that is where earned wage access comes in. So we effectively give people access to a portion of their salary as they earn it. It is 10 times cheaper than any form of credit in the market. And people are using it responsibly. And that is the beauty of an impact assessment like what we've performed, is we can validate that a service like this has a sustained improvement in people's quality of life.
Let me come back at you, because it's an interesting conversation. Improvements, though, Dion, could also come from salary increases, household changes, maybe debt restructuring, better benefits, broader economic macro factors, rather than just the product or the service itself.
Yes, and I fully agree with that. And that is where a solution like earned wage access has evolved over the last couple of years. So initially, we started out with offering people access to cash that they've already earned. And it started off with just that. But then what we've built in was really educating people on better financial management. So built into a solution like earned wage access, we believe you have to improve people's understanding of financial management and financial services. So that's baked into our service offering. But then it's also looking at how can we utilize and leverage the base of customers that we support to bring services and goods at an even cheaper service. So what we do is we go to service providers and we buy bulk, and we're actually able to offer services to customers, being employees, cheaper than they can get it anywhere else in the market. So it's not just giving people access to money. It's not just giving people education, it's also giving them services cheaper than they can find anywhere else that's fit for purpose. And one nice thing about a solution like Earned Wage Access, because we're a B2B2C offering, PayMeNow goes in the market, finds the best services possible, but we still have to convince the employers that this is a good service. And they are always able to say, you know what, guys, you brought us a new insurance product, PayMeNow. We like it. We're going to test it in the market. It's cheaper than anywhere else that anyone can find it. We'd love to offer this to our staff. And that is really the beauty of this model. It's B2B2C with the employer always being in control.
Dion, let me ask you two questions about behavior and dependency then. Surely regular access can create a rolling shortfall at payday, and that entrenches surely a pay cycle gap, or at least has the potential to do so.
Yeah, Jeremy, that's a good question. And you know, when we present our offering to clients, that's always the first hesitation that comes to mind. And the interesting thing about our solution is, and I mentioned it earlier, the employers are able to control what the access level is that employees can access. And typically that's 25% of an employee's net pay. But what we found in our service is that the average employee only uses half of what is made available. And I think the mindset change here is different. When people borrow out in the market, people almost treat a loan as extra money. And they might not repay this month and they might avoid and change their phone numbers and their bank accounts. Whereas Earned Wage Access is access to your hard-earned money, and what you use will come off your salary at the end of the month. So the way in which people interact with the service is really, really different. And the beauty for us has been only typically half gets used of what is made available. And the other interesting thing on those goods and services I mentioned, that comes at absolute zero fees to the employee. So if you go in the market, the average person tops up their airtime every 3 days, you will always pay a fee for that in the market, and you need money to buy airtime. With Earned Wage Access, we'll give you the airtime at no fees, and what you use comes off at the end of the month.
And that's where we are going to leave it. Dion Nobrega, Chief Executive Officer, PayMeNow. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.